Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to the Starcast for the week of June 22nd, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me is my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Let's take a look at some space weather from spaceweather.com. So, Mike, what's happening with the sun over the next couple days?
Well, we have a low chance of X-class flares, just about 10%, with a slightly greater chance of M-class flares at around 55%. That's for the next 48 hours. As far as geomagnetic storms, there is a 15% chance of active conditions over the next 48 hours, 25 to 30% chance of a minor geomagnetic storm in the next 48 hours, and 25 to 40% chance of a severe geomagnetic storm. So some of the recent activity, especially on the solstice, may have triggered a bit of disruption, and we might see that in the nights to come.
So why is it that we can only basically make a forecast for about 48 hours in advance?
Well, I think that's mostly due to, a combination of the limits of technology, but also, we're looking at, activity on the sun now to extrapolate what's coming our way. And, the X flares and other flares themselves are traveling at the speed of light. So we get that effect and the radio blackouts that it causes within, 8 to 10 minutes at the speed of light. But geomagnetic storms are more charged particles, and they're not traveling at the speed of light. So we have a delay before they reach the Earth.
Okay, so it's about 1 to 2 days, 24 to 48 hours before they actually get here.
Exactly. And some of the forecast is, well, what are the sunspots that are turning toward us, and how active do they appear to be? And so, we may have an inkling that something could let off, but until it actually happens, we're just guessing.
Okay. So, what else is happening this week is the moon is pretty interesting this week, going from the sun to the moon. So early tomorrow morning, the morning of the 23rd, the crescent moon will pass by the Pleiades star cluster. And so it's not quite an occultation like we had back in April 1st, but it's always interesting to see a kind of a dark moon pass right by the Pleiades, which is a very recognizable and a fairly bright star cluster. And the moon will reach its perigee, or which is called the closest point to us in its elliptical orbit around Earth, on about 5 UTC, on June 23rd, 2025, that again tomorrow, basically. And then the new moon will fall on, to be precise, 10:32 UTC on June 25th. And so when we say UTC, of course, we're talking about universal time constant, which is basically Greenwich Mean Time. And so, and that's probably about a 7-hour difference from our particular time zone, which is the Rocky Mountain time zone in the United States. That's kind of the main events for the night sky this week. And in space news, there was a surprise nova this week.
Really exciting.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting news. On June 12th, the All-Sky Automated Survey for Supernova, which is a basically something that scans the night sky, tries to scan it all the time overnight to see if there's any newer supernova occurring. And there's a just difference between a supernova and a nova. So like a supernova is a huge star explosion that we can see in actually faraway galaxies. It's that massive and huge. Whereas regular novas, or, you know, even though they are a pretty violent event, it is a star exploding. Those are often more from, actually, we see those that are in our Milky Way galaxy. And so this planet, the sun that novaed this week was formerly named V462 Luppi. And it was a notable star. It was previously at magnitude 22 that wouldn't even appear on most star charts. And so when it first appeared, it started shining around magnitude 8.5 and then continued to brighten. Till last night, it was a magnitude 5.6, which is quite bright. And you can actually, that would be visible to the naked eye in a dark sky. And of course you could, and it would be easily seen with binoculars. And actually I got out there last night with the binoculars and was able to kind of pick it out. And so, you know, it's basically there was where there was nothing, a few nights ago, there's a bright star now. In other news, can you tell us a little bit about the Rubin telescope there, Mike?
Yeah, this week we're going to get our first look at images created out of the Rubin Observatory using the world's largest digital camera. And the Rubin Observatory is going to create the ultimate time lapse of the night sky, repeatedly scanning the sky and creating an ultra-wide, ultra-high definition time lapse record of our universe. That observatory is named for Dr. Vera Rubin, an astronomer who is also honored on a new U.S. coin. So I am really looking forward to seeing those images as they are released.
Yeah,
and so include a link to that observatory's website so that listeners can keep an eye out and watch those images. Press conference is going to happen on tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern time.
Oh, great! That's really exciting when we get a new observatory online, and it's also I'm really happy that it's honoring Dr. Vera Rubin, who's a prominent female astronomer that's done a lot of really important work. So then this week's discussion, we're going to talk about astronomy on the cheap. And I'm not a rich man, and I don't think that you are either, Mike. And
no.
I probably spend too much on astronomy stuff, but there's ways to do that on the cheap.
That's right. I'll tell you, I got my first real dedicated observing around a campfire as a young adult. I started camping, and a friend had made he was an astronomer in grad school, and he'd made some star charts that he photocopied and gave to me. And what I discovered was really wonderful about these is that they only had printing on one side of the page, and I could stand over a campfire and use the star chart to, first of all, block the light of the campfire so that my eyes could stay dark adjusted mostly. And second of all, to illuminate the star chart from underneath so that, and this was well before the era of cell phones, so there were no apps to turn to. But I still have these star charts that my friend Larry made for me. And they were incredibly useful to be able to stand there and, you know, find one constellation, start with the Big Dipper, and, start to learn the names of those stars, and then find, the next constellation, the Little Dipper, and to go on from there. And, of course, the Summer Triangle. So I got really good at the summer sky just by hopping from constellation to constellation using these one-sided star charts. And okay, we do have a link of some downloadable sky maps that when printed would be single page. So you can do the same thing if you want.
Oh, well, yeah, and then of course a step up at from that is what they call a printed planosphere, and I have a little one. I think it cost me less than $10 that glows in the dark, and it's basically a cardboard device that allows you to rotate the night sky chart around to the night that you're looking at, and then it actually has glow in the dark ink on it, and I can just sit out there in a lawn chair in the dark sky, and be able to pick out those stars. So to me, the cheapest way that you can do astronomy is just to have a comfortable outdoor chair and a planisphere or star chart. And then practically everybody out there has a pair of binoculars, or you can get a super cheap pair of binoculars. And I would call that the next step up.
That's right. And some binoculars will support a tripod mount. And so if you are going to invest, I recommend, I've got a pair of Pentax, they're 10 by 50 focals, and I am able to screw that onto a tripod mount, and then I can find my target, and I don't have to suffer the jitter of holding it by hand. I get a nicer, clearer view, yeah.
Yeah, and they also, when we say, when you said 10 by 50, that means that it's 10x magnification by 50 millimeter objective lens. And so, so binoculars are kind of in that realm. And so if you have a 10x, 50 or 10x 70, those are sufficient binoculars that you can see a lot of night sky objects, down to magnitude, seven, and if you're in dark skies. And like you said, having a tripod mount, it really helps that out. And in addition to binoculars, there's also little spotting scopes. And so they're basically half a binocular. And those are fairly inexpensive as well. And so those also work fairly well.
Yeah, I recently inherited a spotting scope with, and this is a very old, it's a Swift brand, and it's kind of got this marine green finish. I would estimate that this thing was probably manufactured, and this is full, it advertises as fully coated. This thing has got to have been made in the 40s or 50s.
And you can still see stars through it, right?
That's right. Came with a set of five eyepieces. So designed for astronomy, came with a star map. And
what did that set you back?
Well, it was actually given to me by a friend who inherited it from her father. She said, well, I didn't know that I was going to have a use for it, but you might. So I was grateful to add an antique to my collection that certainly still has use.
Yeah. And for me, actually, because of the way my eyes are offset, is I actually can look through a spotting scope easier and better than I can binoculars. So that's one of the, when I go camping or backpacking or something, and I don't want to haul anything that's too heavy, I usually just have this little spotting scope that works pretty well. And so also nowadays, of course, we've all got phones, and some of these newer phones, particularly from Samsung and iPhones, are getting to where they're really sensitive to dark, can do some night sky imaging. And of course, the most important piece of equipment for this would be having a tripod, and I can't overemphasize, what an investment a tripod is. Like you said, for binoculars or for a spotting scope, and especially if you can get a phone mount and you can mount your phone on a tripod, you can do some pretty cool night sky stuff.
That's right. And I use the apps Skyview for Android and Stellarium for Android. And sure, there's a Stellarium for iPhone out there just to help me navigate. But I have used my phone to do long exposures and can capture the Milky Way, can capture Aurora if it's bright enough. And so that takes getting into the manual mode and adjusting exposure times to being somewhere between 15 and 30 seconds, maybe setting a high ISO and setting a manual focus, of course.
Yeah, and you can actually, there's one app that I think is both Android and iPhone is called Nightcap that I use, and it uses long exposure and stacking to do imagery. And again, if it's mounted on a tripod, you can get good Milky Way and stuff like that. And then another thing that you can do with your phone is something called digiscoping, and yeah, are you aware of that, Mike?
I have just a little bit. I've not tried it myself, but I know people who do.
Okay, so
So.
digiscoping is you can get a little adapter that can that basically holds your phone close to the eyepiece of a spotting scope or binoculars or an inexpensive telescope, and allows you to use your phone, use the telescope or the spotting scope to do the magnification, and then your phone does the actual capture. And so I had really, really good luck with that. And particular, like things like lunar eclipses, where you can actually run a time lapse on your phone mounted to a scope. And so that was one of the things that, and it's also very portable. Like you said, camping and backpacking is you just need the little adapter clip that clips onto your spotting scope, a tripod, and your phone, and you can actually do some pretty decent star imaging. So you and I do a lot of time lapses, and so we use digital cameras. So can you tell us a little bit about your entry into using digital cameras for night sky imaging?
Sure. I started out in probably about 2011 when the Sony mirrorless cameras became affordable enough. It was always for me a matter of, well, let me back up. I had a Meade 8-inch Dobsonian in the mid 90s, late 90s, and I did buy a USB eyepiece. So it had a little camera built in with a USB cable, and I took that and hooked it up to my computer, which I then hooked up to a projector, and I projected a probably a 8, 10 foot high live image of the moon on my bedroom wall. So that was kind of fun. But it was pretty low resolution, low quality. It wasn't until, say, 2010 that the Sony mirrorless cameras became inexpensive enough to actually, buy and start doing more serious time lapse and astrophotography. And it was the Next 5 series that got me started. And for $600, I was able to get a camera that could take long exposures. With a wide angle lens and looking for around 18 millimeters, sort of at the starting point of the kit lens, is fine. And I went through quite a few Sony Next 5s between 2011 and say 2016, 2017, mostly just burning up the shutters by taking millions of pictures every year. And I'm now using a Sony A6300 and a Sony A7 R3, which is, on the higher end, full frame. And they're both excellent cameras. I've kind of just stuck with Sony because of the investment of lenses that I have. And they've just served me very well. And the more recent models have a silent shutter feature so that instead of actuating the shutter, there's no mechanical movement for a shot. So these cameras have been more durable and have endured, you know, sub-zero, minus 10 degree temperatures, up to, you know, 100 degree in the daytime, for hours in the sun, hours in the freezing, getting, you know, rime and, or, you know, frost all over the camera. They've been just remarkably resilient and provided me with years of enjoyment.
Yeah, we could both be accused of camera abuse. There's probably no better way to abuse a camera than to shoot nighttime sky lapses year round. So I've got my investment is in Panasonic Lumix cameras, which are also mirrorless cameras, and again primarily due to the fact that that was where my lens investment was before I started doing a lot of the night sky and time lapses and that sort of thing. But there's not only time lapses. You know, time lapses are very gratifying, and you know, especially for the Milky Way and looking for meteors and that sort of thing. But you can also use just a fairly inexpensive digital camera and on a tripod and do imaging of say the moon, or you know, with a proper filter you can do the sun and get sunspots. And then if we talk about deep sky photography or deep sky observing, then we get into where we want to actually track these deep sky objects so that we can kind of follow along with them as the Earth rotates. And so I know that you've got a star tracker, and how does that, and what does that cost, and how does that work for you, Mike?
Yeah, it's the SkyWatcher Star Adventurer, and I got the photography package. So it's on the lower end as far as trackers go, but obviously useful enough for a lightweight telescope or a, you know, we're talking about $500, which, you know, compared to amount for a larger optical assembly would be several thousand dollars. So I have to set my latitude on a dial, and I have to polar align it. And that's probably the most difficult part. It has a small built-in reticule with an illuminator so that I can align it with the North Star, and then I have to account for the particular time. And it takes a bit of effort, you know, sometimes 20 minutes to get it well aligned. The mount has to be leveled, the tripod has to be leveled, the mount has to be aligned, polar aligned, and then I have to select the correct tracking setting, because if I'm tracking the moon, which I use this most frequently for lunar eclipses, there's one setting because of the distance of the moon to the Earth, and its orbital period is going to be different from the apparent motion of the stars with the Earth's rotation. So different settings. This also does a time-lapse mode where I can just set it and tell it to just turn at a constant rate and have some motion of the time-lapse instead of having a fixed view. So it's been a great investment for me, and I've been using this for about 6 years now. The only drawback, like I say, is the need to polar align it. And I've been out for a lunar eclipse, and oh, it's cloudy in the north, and maybe it's going to clear up later. I would really like to have it aligned before the eclipse starts, and sometimes that's just not possible. I have to do kind of my best guess at what's north. And I've had okay results when I've had to guess, but it's obviously more accurate if I can truly find Polaris and have it correctly aligned and balanced. That's the other thing, is that there's a balancing, a counterweight, and that needs to be adjusted based on what kind of lens or tube I'm mounting and the weight of the camera. So that's going to vary from setup to setup.
Yeah, so those are basically, and there's another brand of one of those is from a company called Move Shoot Move, and they're kind of their advantage is their portability is that you can throw them in a backpack if you're going out camping or rafting or kayaking or whatever, and then you can just mount your DSLR camera again on a tripod, and the Star Tracker and. And, you know, it can add a lot of detail to your Milky Way photography if you're actually, you know, tracking those Milky Way stars, so you can do shorter exposures so you get less star trailing. And so so those are kind of a nice economical alternative. And I just want to, you know, talk about, like, you know, what the traditional astrophotography investment was. And so you know, up until a couple years ago, if you wanted to do a really good, you know, deep sky photography and capture nebula and that sort of thing, you had to have pretty significant investment. You had to have a telescope mount that was a tracking mount, and you know, it might have been you know, a go-to mount, which is something that would, you know, you could basically tell it. Where there were three stars to align to, and it would actually tell the telescope where to go. And then you'd have to have the investment of the telescope, and then a camera for the telescope, and then sometimes they have a tracking camera that keeps the telescope on target, and they would have an automated focuser, and before long you could get into an investment of you know, getting close to $10,000 in a decent setup. To do, you know, any, you know, deep sky photography. And so, and that all changed a couple years ago, and with the introduction of what they call smart telescopes. And so, were you aware of that when that happened, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, you were actually the one that I think turned me on to the C-Star. I have another friend who bought a dwarf, so I've seen that in action as well. And I went and bought a C-Star for my use during the solar eclipse of April 2024, and was really very, very pleased with the performance of that just as a solar telescope. And I use it probably half the time I use it is for capturing sunspots.
So, yeah, so... We're talking about there's a couple brands out there that are in the sub $500 range, and so there were some smart telescopes that were kind of introduced, you know, about 5 years ago that were, you know, kind of on the high end where they were, you know, in the, you know, $5,000 range, you know, the $2,000 to $5,000 range, and you know that was beyond my budget and interest in. Doing, you know, astronomy. But when these smart telescopes came out, there are a couple of them. One is called the Dwarf 2 or Dwarf 1, Dwarf 2, and then from a brand called ZWO, there's two telescopes that they have out, smart telescopes, the C-Star S50, which is a 50-millimeter objective lens, and the C-Star S30, which is obviously a 30-millimeter objective lens. And so these basically were game changers. I mean, the first time I got that out and did some night sky imaging, it was like, wow, this is not difficult, number one. You know, like you said, with a star tracker, having to deal with polar alignment, you know, knowing what your latitude is, what time it was, you know, and by the time you get everything set up in a traditional telescope or a star tracker, it, you know, you've pretty much lost interest or the weather's changed or, it's, you know, and especially if it's cold out, it's just not a pleasurable experience. But if you can grab one of these smart telescopes and literally the S50 is that you go out, plop it out on its tripod, turn on the app and say, go image Orion. And it goes to it and it starts taking pictures and it does all these things that the expensive astrophotography rigs used to do, where it has the camera, it has the autofocuser, it has a filter for the for light pollution, and it does internal stacking where it takes these short exposures of images and stacks them together to make a large exposure. And then at the end of the night, it spits out a JPEG for you, or it can spit out a more sophisticated file format, a FITS format file that you can process in post on your computer, and you can do some really fantastic deep sky imaging. And so, and that wasn't a big interest of mine before, because there's so many people with the more expensive rigs that did deep space stuff that it wasn't economically viable for me to do that.
Same. It's really exciting to kind of watch as the image develops, as it stacks image after image, and you start with maybe the faintest of smudge that shows up in the cell phone view, and then suddenly you get a little bit more definition with every subsequent image that's stacked on top. So it's like we're trading some of the nice aperture you get on a big telescope for just time. May not be able to grab as many photons with any given image, but we can extend the amount of time to grab many photons anyway.
Yeah, and I think that, to me, the biggest thing is that this really democratizes the hobby, as it were. We always had a saying that the gifted whenever you get that gift of the telescope, the 4.5-inch reflector telescope that somebody gets you for a Christmas present. We called those hobby killers, because people would, try to go through the hassle of setting them up and looking through the telescope and not getting really satisfying results. And so a lot of people lost interest in the hobby of amateur astronomy, just because of the telescopes were so difficult to operate.
That's right, and there's just such a nice range of costs out there, starting with the C-Star S30 at about $400, and the S50 being a little bit more, another 150 or so, $550, $600. The Dwarf is comparable to that. There's the Vespera and Vespera Pro, which are going to jump up to $2,000 to $3,000, and then from there on up into the Celestron, Astrograph series, running from 3,000 to, 6,000 or 8,000, depending on the size of scope that you want, but all kind of, based around some of the same concepts of let's stack images and capture light over time, which of course is something that our eyes just can't do by themselves. So.
And of course, before these smart telescopes, what I would do for nights for deep sky photography is, rather than me make the investment in these sophisticated telescope setups, is you can rent observatory time. And so you can, there's several of these observatories out there where you can actually just basically rent time on an observatory that has a sophisticated telescope and sophisticated imaging equipment. And you can tell them to say, I would like to have you point this at, this nebula, and, for on a clear sky night. And they, you pay them money and they send you images that you can post-process and turn into some really, world-class, deep space object photography. And so I've, told people in the past, if you really want to get into deep sky imaging, is don't necessarily make that investment on your own. Invest the money in just getting the images made by a professional observatory and sent to you that you can process and make your own. And so I will include a couple links to one observatory in particular is called the InSight Observatory, and they have actually three or four different observatory locations that you can order images from.
Yeah. And hey, Jay, there's another thing that's not on your list that I think we should talk about, and that's star parties. People can look for local amateur astronomy groups and get out and have the benefit of their neighbors' telescopes who enjoy sharing and giving tours of the night sky. That's something we do here in Crestone, Colorado, where I live. We've hosted two star parties this year, and we have plans for at least three more, including our big annual celebration on August 30th and 31st at the Colorado College Baca campus. We've got some exciting presenters lined up this year, including a physics professor who will be giving a presentation on archaeoastronomy.
Yeah, and these are usually free too. And so I'm a member of the El Valle Astronomy Club here in Taos area, and we just actually last night we canceled our star party due to clouds or postponed it until next week. But again, yeah, these public star parties is you can get out there, you can talk to people that are even more expert than you and I, and look through their telescopes and take advantage of that. In addition to that is there's also public observatories. And so I know in Colorado we the there was a couple of public observatories where they would just basically you could go to these observatories on certain nights of the week and look through their telescopes for visual observing. And so, and again, it was hosted by an expert, and they're going to point the telescope for you, and you can look and look through these super expensive, telescopes that are often owned by colleges or universities. One of the big ones was the DU Refractor in Denver, Colorado, and we're actually, in the process of building the largest public telescope in the Southwest United States here in Taos. So we're on kind of a 3-year ramp up to add a new 36-inch Dobsonian telescope that was donated to the University of New Mexico at Taos. And so they're basically building a what they call a roll-off rooftop observatory that will be open to the public so they can look through the telescopes that way.
Awesome. That's great.
So yeah, these are some of the ways so you can you don't have to throw a lot of money at the hobby of astronomy. And in fact, just being able to know where to look and keep your eye out for star parties and some of the more inexpensive equipment, you can get a very enjoyable experience. So, we tell that's how we do astronomy on the cheap. So I want to go ahead and wrap that up, and we'll thank all our listeners for checking out this podcast. Be sure to comment, like, subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about or less about. And you can also check out our respective websites. Mike's is wildernessvagabonds.com, and mine is skylapser.com. And our intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. From Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is G. Schaefer and Mike Lewinsky wishing you all clear skies.